Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel. He scores! Cortinel!
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped-down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage? Guaranteed. Offside? For sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Oh, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. You live in Edmonton, Russ, and it's, 8 degrees.
Oh, boy.
Last day of August when we record. From the bottom of my heart, weather's gone, Rusty. It's all over here. I hate living in Canada for this. I hate it.
The weather?
The weather, man. The weather.
You don't hate anything. You don't like it.
Don't use hate, Rusty.
Don't use the word hate.
I don't like it. Welcome to the show, everybody. Another episode of The Suspendables is moving right into your face right now. We're into show... I don't know how many right... we should count them. You know what I'm going to do, Russ? That was the great sound of a White Claw opening, by the way. I'm going to count, instead of counting the shows by the number of shows, okay, let's say for the sake of numbers, it's 60. That's probably, can we go with 180 White Claws?
Oh. Yeah,
three a show might not be a stretch.
No, it's probably right. The one show I did with Gretz, I had five.
Okay, so our new introduction is, welcome to number one, welcome one, to number one, 180, one, 181.
Spit it out.
It's episode White Claw 181. We're back again after a great show last week. Wasn't sure what the response would be. We had Steve Laurie, former PGA player, who's a friend of yours, lives up there in Gosser or hangs out there. Good career, won a few times, all through playoffs. And we had a nice hour chatting with him. I never know. It's tough looking at your press clippings, Russ, you know. Because you don't know how people are going to react. But the reaction was all positive. They loved it. It was great. I had a buddy of mine from way down in Nova Scotia who was a big listener to the show and said, yeah, that was great. That was a great off-the-page thing. And he had a couple of hilarious stories.
What do you mean down in Nova Scotia? Wouldn't it be over?
No, if you look at a map, Russ, Edmonton, people think it's just in Western Canada.
Ah, that's right. It's further north.
If you look in Edmonton, man, and go straight across,
okay, yeah,
a degree of latitude, okay, and you go straight across, and everyone knows that Hudson's Bay, okay, is very far north, and Edmonton fires right through the middle of it on a degree of latitude. So we're way up north.
Hence the weather.
Hence the weather, man.
You're making me cold just thinking about it.
Yeah, shut up. Yeah, you get no sympathy. So, anyway, I thought I better not read the react. People are pissed because they want all these stories from Russ all the time. But he was great.
Yeah.
And so I loved reading the press clippings from it. And did you ever, Rusty, when you were before we get to what's on the show today? Well, I'll tell you now. We've got a couple things to talk about. One of them was because we're all friends. Dustin Johnson almost won again in a great high drama finish at the FedEx Cup, but he goes into the final, the top 30, which is it may be one of the biggest championships in sports now, Russ.
15 million for first, 5 for second.
It's an incredible deal. We'll talk more about that. Canadian Mackenzie Hughes gets in the final 30. He makes a 5.
Isn't that great?
At the end, yeah, and. So we want to talk about that. I want to talk about that thing they were saying now is life-altering for Mackenzie Hughes.
And
I thought, I got to ask Russ, I want to speak to you about what might be life-altering moments in sports, either for yourself or other guys. The playoffs, of course, are underway. One of the things this week, amongst other things, but one of the big ones that came up.
Feed
was
your fucking cat, would you?
I just did. I fed them.
Oh, my God.
You know what happens is they hear me say the name Russ.
Yeah.
And they walk over and take a crap on my suitcase.
like you said, you're living out of your suitcase.
I'm living out of my suitcase, man. Big dirty hit in the Boston-Tampa series. We're going to talk about that. One of the other players, Matthew Tkachuk, who plays for the Flames, Couldn't play against Dallas. They got wiped out against Dallas. They lost. He got concussed and couldn't play. Calgary ends up losing in a sort of disappointing deal that everyone thought they would compete better. So the usual shit happens there, Russ, where the media jumps on a couple of their big players. Johnny Gaudreau and Sean Monahan, I think. They just ripped them. Happens. You've been around sports a long time. And then Tkachuk, when normally players sort of stand down and don't react, he goes not crazy, but he comes to their defense. So I want to talk to you about that, about what you do about the press stuff. And then, of course, the big story were teams that had decided to postpone games in the NBA, in baseball, and in hockey, with the fallout from the Jacob Blake killing that happened this week. And so I want to ask you about all that. But so that coming up on the show today. But press clippings, I had mentioned that. I got to admit, Russ, I've always heard guys going, yeah, I don't read them. And then some guy, a hockey player will say, I never read my stuff. And then one of the other players on his team will be there and then look over at me and go, not true. He reads he reads every one. And I said, what were you like, Russ, in that? Because it can't be fun. It can't be fun, man. It must be fun when you win.
Yeah.
And go read the story the next day. But what were you like with reading the press stuff?
I tried not to. What I didn't do was listen to all the radio talk shows, because those are brutal.
That bodes bad for me. I thought you liked my show when we did radio.
Yeah, right. I listened to your show while I was on hold, freaking waiting to do the interview for an hour. Fuck.
Boy, you really let that go, eh?
Yeah,
I did that. It was 20 years ago.
Yeah, bastard. But so I didn't listen to the radio talk shows because they are ruthless and brutal. And the reason I know that is because when I was in Montreal, Stéphane Richer is sitting right beside me, and he sits down and he goes, did you listen to the show today on the way in? And I lived right across the street from the Forum, so it was a walk, not a drive like all the other guys. I said, no, I didn't. He goes, oh, they were just fucking crucifying you today. I'm like, that's exactly why I don't listen to it. And then the newspapers were always in the locker room, so it was pretty tough not to read what was going on. And you want to read, the other stories from other teams. So you'd be fibbing if you said you didn't read the newspapers, because they were in every locker room and every bathroom and on every plane and every hotel room. But so I did read occasionally and most of the time, but the radio shows I didn't listen to, and I didn't watch a lot of TV either, sports channels or anything, because it's pretty tough.
Do you ever recall Russ saying when you did read one, so say writer comes on and goes, you know what, they got to trade Russ, or what a terrible performance. They think the guy, say he hits you pretty hard. Any follow up, Russ? Would you wait for the guy?
I remember two instances where it helped me. It was in Toronto, and then this writer wrote a story that Gary Lehman and I were going to get sent down to St. Catharines to the farm team. And that was the first I'd heard of any mention of me going to the minor, so that made me work a lot harder in practice, and I never went to the minors. And then the second one is Ian McIntyre in Vancouver wrote a story about me that somebody said I was bad influence on the younger players.
Why?
Something about the locker room. He said, and he told me it was a source from the team. So that was even worse. So either a player, a coach, or management said something to him. And so I did confront him, because it really upset my sister at the time, who lives in Port Alberni. And she phoned me crying that this was a horrible, article, and it wasn't true. And the young guys freaking loved me. And I had them all over for dinner all the time. And my wife and I took care of them and lent them TVs and couches and helped them. Like every team I played on, I really wanted to help the young guys. So anyways, it really hurt my feelings and pissed me off. So I fucking lost it on them. And I and it wasn't pretty and scared.
What'd you do? Or just verbal?
It was verbal. and it was harsh. Yeah. Harsh in the locker room. And he's 6 foot freaking four or something.
Right.
He's a big guy. Not a big guy. He's a skinny guy, but he's tall, right? And so it was really emotional for me. I was my feelings, and I was pissed off. So it was a horrible combination.
I remember, when someone sent me a question too. Where I throw it out there for questions, and they got lots of good stuff that they ask of you that they want to hear from you. And someone said, how did you guys meet? You know, it was one of the questions one day, and I always remember. My first feeling, I came back from Phoenix.
Yeah.
And talking about, that was the first fantasy camp. Mm-hmm. And of course, I was all a flutter, right? It was just such a cool thing. And it was to be involved in. And someone said, who was there? You know, and I was like, well, of course, this guy, that guy, and that guy. And then your name came up, and I said, I'd met you over the years before this, but we never spent any time. I'd run into you at restaurants at press games or something.
Yeah.
And I said, but Russ Courtneau really scares me. I did. I remember saying, because of, I forget what it was, of some practical joke or when you slammed your heel on my toe or something. And I was going, he's kind of frightening.
Unpredictable.
I was scared of the guy. I was intimidated from the guy. And I was afraid to rip him.
Yeah.
You know? After that, though, what I did come away with one time, you may not remember this. You may not remember this, but... it was one of the nicest things that anyone's ever done for me is I was doing a gig somewhere. You were there and someone was giving me a hard time and to the point where it was embarrassing.
Yeah.
And they were ripping me and you were sitting near a table and you came flying right over, jumped right in between the guy. And you said, maybe you should calm down.
Yeah.
And I always said, because you played life in hockey, and I said, I got to ask Russ, that really meant a lot, And where I said, this is unbelievable, this guy who I was kind of intimidated by, I thought maybe didn't like me, maybe was pissed with me, and then you were the first guy to step up. And I always wondered, you must have had, I bet you were the go-to guy in high school or something, that you must have come to guys' defenses when a lot of people back in the day, when bullying was alive and well. And I always thought if that was the case with me, I want to have Russ Courtneau on my side.
Well, I'm not a tough guy, but I had a lot of protectors around me when I was younger because I wasn't very big. And even when I played in the NHL, I wasn't a big player. I was probably on the small side.
Right.
But I, when people are chirping like that, and that guy was drunk and he was saying shit to you, he's trying to be funny. He wants to be on the stage. And I think I said to him, hey, we got one fucking comedian in the room. We don't need two, and you're fucking awful, so shut the fuck up.
I know it was. I felt proud. You know? Yeah. I was like, yeah, Rusty.
Yeah. And people, those trips, guys are letting loose, and then they get to the point where they think they're, most of them are just awesome, and then there's the odd idiot who thinks because he's been around everybody for so many days that he can act up and... I just felt like I could, I can verbally go over there and tell the guy to shut up. And if he wants to go outside, I'll tell him to talk to Jeff. Yeah. But I felt like with you, when we first met, if I went on the offensive, then you were going to lay off me.
Right.
Which worked. Oh, my God. Because you abused everybody in the room. Many, many times. I mean, you hit me a couple times. In Vegas, you hit me hard a couple times. And I mean, once our friendship grew, I just remember the one time that stuck out for me was our second Courtneau Classic in Victoria. And you had a ginger ale going and you weren't on your game like you were before. And I went up to you and I said, so how long have you been sober for? And you looked at me like, because you were trying to pretend like you were having you had a drink in your hand. I don't know if you remember that. And I think you had just hit sobriety maybe.
Right.
Maybe, I don't know, or you were trying, I don't know. But you were definitely different. And anyways, I noticed you were, Usually we had to fucking yank you off the stage.
Right.
And this time you're like, okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Get on. Drive home safe.
So was I drinking or not?
No, you weren't. You were drinking ginger ale. But
it was a tough one to go through.
You were faking it. Like you were faking like you were drinking.
Right, right.
So yeah, I did.
Anyway, I always appreciate that. And I think hockey players, I got killed another time here in my blurry days. And I got I was way offside at an event, thinking it was great. And then I got back to Ottawa. I flew out here. I was living in Ottawa at the time. I flew out here to do an event for Kevin Lowe. And then I flew back home, and I got fired. Someone mm-hmm. who was at that dinner I was at had hired me for something down the road, like three months later. And they phoned me and said, we're going to pass.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'd never been let go from any event, you know? Never.
Yeah.
And they said, you're just a little too much. And I went, oh, my God. You know, I just remember my balls dropping, going, what did I do?
Well, fuck. And actually, it happened twice, because we've had three events. We just never called you.
In any event, I started phoning my friends, right, who were at it, you know? And it was, each phone call was getting worse.
Yeah.
I phoned my best buddy, you know, looking for the praise, right? You're looking for it. And I go, hey, you're at the event. What'd you think? And he goes, I've seen you better. Right? So it was a little soft, you know, jab. I've seen you better. All right. Hung up the phone. Call another guy.
Yeah.
You know? Hey, I did, that was fun last night. He goes, well, it was fun. It was fun until you went after that old lady.
Yeah, and grabbed her hair, pulled her wig off.
Yes, that's right. I did. Yeah. By accident, you know? And then third guy was, dude, I don't know what you're on, but you better get off. It just got worse and worse. And anyway, I got let go from the gig, and people were killing me. I said, I'm done. Yeah. Like the old Western thing. I'm done in this town, you know?
I was living in L.A., and I heard that story. I wasn't at the show, but I think my brother called me. Somebody called him from Edmonton in Victoria. He called me in L.A. and said,
Jerome's lost his mind.
Oh, my God. Jimmy lost it last night. Dancing on the table, pulled the... The guy who hired him, he pulled his wife's wig off.
It was Daryl Cates' mother.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I didn't pull it off, but it moved. I went to punch him in the head, and it rocked back and forth. And anyway, and he phoned. Cates phoned Kevin and said, who touched my mother? Right? And Kevin had to leave early. Like, it was his event, but he had to leave. And then I got this phone call from Kevin going, hey, pal.
Yeah.
It's
over. Scooter.
No, what happened? I'm getting more calls than I do when I'm making trades. You know, he was with the team. In any event, back to what we were talking about, he was the first guy. He was the first guy to phone all those people back personally and say, you got to dial it back. Mm-hmm. You know, he came to my defense and said, this guy's done more for this town. He's been volunteering to do events for years. It was just on and on and on. How gracious he was and telling everyone gets a mulligan, you know?
Yeah.
Everyone gets a mulligan.
Well,
and it was
great.
A hockey player, you know? Yeah. It was another hockey player who, and I find them a lot like that, you know? I've been around and seen them do, like I've seen you do wonderful things and like you did for me. And I don't know. It's something that's bred in hockey players where they're never going to let a guy go down, you know, sort of thing. Never.
The one thing about winning in the NHL, if you have a strong unity and in the locker room and on the ice, it adds into wins and fun and family. And so all of us have learned and played on teams where you don't have that. And when you play on the good ones, you can really, really see it and feel it. And so as you get to play, and if you're lucky enough to play a long time, it just becomes part of your character, I guess, part of your personality. And
right,
you know, Mark Messier was the best. I mean, he would, when the team was struggling, he'd pull everybody together, not pull everybody apart. And
right,
when things were good, you know, and playing well, you didn't have to hear from him all the time, but he straightened the room out really fast. Bob Gainey was really good. Wayne Gretzky, of course, played with him.
Right.
Wayne was more of a lead by example on the ice, quiet in the locker room, but when he spoke, everybody listened, of course. And then Wendell Clark, another guy, just led by example. And you want to follow those people. You want to be part of that.
Right.
And so defending one another is, you know, it's ongoing. I've told, right. I, I've, you know, when Wendell Clark and I played together, and after the whistle, he said, if the shit is hitting the fan, if somebody's on you, he goes, count to three, and if I'm not there, you're on your own.
Right. Right.
But he was, you know, he was looking out for me and scared the shit out of anybody who touched me, and it was awesome, and I'll never forget that, how it felt to be looked after and how it felt to have somebody, a teammate, a friend, a brother that had your back. And it's a beautiful thing when you know you walk into a room and people respect you and also want to look out for one another.
Yeah, it. I've always said the my favorite thing to ever hear, and sports, you know, you're talking about sports, and hockey's not unique to that. All athletes have this fraternity.
I thought you were going to say late at night when a girl would say, okay, I'll go home with you. That was a favorite. Your favorite thing to hear. Didn't happen very often, but man, when it did.
Yeah. Woo! Check, the requirements. Please. The requirements seem to drop the more they say no, Russ, until you get a yes.
Yeah.
But it's the great side of sports, right? And I'm sure it's why a lot of people, you know, where kids develop and they grow through it and stuff like that. And my favorite thing ever that someone ever said to me, and when I get to use it, people just love it. When you're stressed. Or you got a lot of shit on your plate or something, and I'm telling someone, and they'll go like this, why don't you let me take care of that?
Yeah.
It's just like,
yeah.
Oh, are you any good?
Yeah.
Like my taxes or something, and or whatever, you know? Jeez. And sports is a lot like that. You know, I'll look after that for you.
Isn't that every time you go for dinner with Gretz?
Every time, yeah, I'll take care of that.
I'll take care of that.
Yeah, I got the alligator arms, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I'll tell you a funny story about, you know, what can you do, right? What, like, you guys are all well off. You're super generous. And, you know, I happen to be a friend, but I'm nowhere near in the league, you know, mm-hmm. of you guys. I don't have the money, you know, I don't make a bunch of money. And so what do you do, right? And your generosity is always, you know, picking up a green fee and always for dinner and shit like that. And you know, you never allow it, right? You guys are cool enough, right? That no one goes, okay, Jerome, you pick it up, right? When there's 90 people there for dinner.
Yeah.
And I remember going to, when Wayne got traded to L.A., the year he got traded, me and his brother were living here. We were roommates, Glennie Gretzky and I, and they won to go to Game 7 against the Oilers down in, I think it was Game 7, the first year that he got traded. And the next morning, we're in Edmonton. Wayne's got to fly back. And the next morning, a courier shows up with two tickets to go to L.A., you know, from Gretz. And we called it, Glenn and Jungle's Excellent Adventure. Okay.
Oh, boy.
We went down there. And they finished the game. They won the game, as everyone knows. And it was a shit show after, right, down in the locker room. And,
yeah.
And everyone's going to go out, and Gretz has got it all. You know, Gretz is no idiot, right? He'll organize everything too. You know, and
yeah.
He's like, okay, everyone's going to meet at, I think it was a place called Bar One. Was it a big bar?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's
on Sunset.
That was the flavor of the month, you know, to go to that mm-hmm. place. And he said, okay, Jimmy, you go with these six or eight people. I'll look after them. And I said, no problem, you know. And I went to, you know, and I went to leave, and he went, here, hang on, you know. And he handed me like $1,000, right?
Yeah.
And I gave it back to him. Right, I said, no, I'll look after this. You know, how bad can it be? Six people having drinks, and he said, just take it, okay? And I'll see when I'm there. I said, no, I won't. You know, and I gave it back to him. And I went in there and I said, I got it. Okay, I wanted to buy everyone a round of drinks, okay? And it was my first time in L.A. Okay, and I was just at the same time going, Jesus, $20 was a little much for the coat check. Okay, right? I go, that's a little steep, you know? And by the way, Glennie, you owe me 20. I picked yours up. 40 large to get into the... And then another double sawbuck to get in. So I'm down 80 already. 20 to get in. And I'm 20 for the... So I'm down 80.
Yeah.
And I get in there and I'm sort of going, oh, all right, everyone get around. It's on me.
Yeah.
Okay? Anyway, I see people ordering. I order a couple beers, a couple shots. And... we do a few other things, and the girl comes with the tab. Okay, now maybe it was a couple of drinks. The girl comes with a tab, and it's $2,200. Okay, someone ordered four bottles of champagne. Okay.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no.
And I'm not lying. I'm going.
Oh no.
What the? Anyway, I can see past the waitress is Gretz coming over, laughing his head off, going, "How's it going, Scooter? Yeah. With picking up the drinks in L.A. You know?
Oh God.
Anyway,
that was a good little bar. There was a pool table when you walk in the front door to the right, and I went out there a couple times, maybe.
Yeah.
And yeah, right. And so I had a house up the street in Hollywood Hills, not too far from there. So anyways, I went in there one night and with a buddy from Winnipeg, and he was trying to get into the movie business. And he's like, "Do you play pool?" And I'm going, "Not very good. Like, I'm really, I like playing, but I'm just not that good." So he goes, "Well, let's put, you know, put the quarters on, and then you're, you know, the guys own the freaking table." Well, no fighting, but I mean, it's these two freaking studs, at least they think they are. And you have to pay, you can gamble against them, but as long as they win, they hold the table, I guess. Right. So, and your quarters are the order of which are the next guys to play.
Right.
So we put our quarters up and we put down, and then they go, you want to bet? So we bet like $5 or $10 each. Right. So we get in, I freaking sweep the table. And no one knows who I am, right? I'm new to this bar, and everyone's looking at me like, "Oh my God, there's a new guy in town, like a new pool player." Fuck. Next game. So these guys actually leave the bar because they're
Minnesota Cardinal.
They're they're 10th or 12th in line because there's freaking quarters all over the tables for the next people who want to play. It was one of those, you know, bad golfers, first round gets a hole in one.
Yeah.
You know, first round of golf and you get a hole in one. It was like that. And my buddy from Winnipeg goes, "I thought you said you weren't good." And I go, "I'm not." "I guess you're making every shot." Anyways, we lost to the next two guys. They kicked our ass. But that's my memory of bar one,
yeah.
Yeah.
A reminder, the Suspendables are engaged on Facebook. Your comments are welcome always.
Canadian golfer Mackenzie Hughes made it into the final 30 of the FedEx Cup, which wouldn't sound like much for people. But if you follow sports at all, you got to follow this story. This FedEx Cup is getting bigger and bigger. What it is the PGA has always suffered from this idea of a playoff or how to get guys playing near the end of the year. And it started years ago where guys would finish the last major was in August or September, and then no one would play the rest of the year. And so we got to come up with some idea to keep guys playing, you know, through all these tournaments, blah, blah, blah. And eventually they came up with this idea of the FedEx Cup, where at the end of the PGA season now there's three tournaments that you qualify for. They start with 100-plus guys in the first one. They cut it down to 70, which they did this week. And then that gets, after the results of this week, it goes down to 30 guys. The money is the big story. Now, if you win next week or you win the FedEx Cup, it's a little complicated, Russ, with the total points and all that. But you win $15 million.
Yeah.
Okay? So everyone kicked up a stink about that, Russ, over the years. It started off as $10 million. But everyone kicked up this fuss going, well, who cares? If it's just a pocket stuffer for these guys, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So who gives a shit? There's nothing in it for anybody, you know?
Right.
There's $10 million. It's like, yeah, but I don't care, you know? Make it so that something... So what happens now? Make it something bigger. So what happens now is, yes, the money's gone up to 15,
mm-hmm.
but you get unbelievable bonuses in terms of qualifying for future events. And now you get in all four majors.
Oh,
if
cool.
If you make the top 30,
wow. Okay,
there's a bunch of...
Oh, so that's a freaking life changer right there.
Life changer. Life altering, and you get some exemptions and a bunch of stuff, right? That that golfers like Mackenzie Hughes, it's life altering. And he slides in a 5-footer. You know, they show the drama yesterday going, okay, he's not going to win the tournament yesterday. You've got Dustin and John Rahm and a couple other guys fighting for it the last few holes, but they flash to Mackenzie Hughes like they do every year. And there's a story of, if this guy makes a par here, he makes
the cut.
He gets PGA status for 2 years. You know,
right.
And if he doesn't, he's back selling clothes at Hudson's Bay. Okay. It's one of the things I love about golf. You're playing for your diapers, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, they go to Mackenzie Hughes. He hit a shot in the middle of the fairway, par four, second shot to the green. And before he hits the second shot, they dial him in and say, if he makes a par here, he's going to make the top 30 and qualify for the Masters, British Open, U.S. Open. If he doesn't, he's toast. Okay, he's life is over, and his run was finished. And anyway, so hits the second shot into the greenside bunker, and he's just deflated. You know?
Yeah,
and he knows absolutely because they put the standings up on the leaderboards.
Oh
up there
my God! So he knows.
He's so he knows it. He's in 28th spot.
Right.
Okay, top 30 make it, and he hits this thing in the bunker, and he short sides it. It's like a front right pin, and he hits it in the front right trap, which is an impossible shot. Right, you want a bunch of green. Anyway, gets up there, hits his third shot out of the trap, and it rolls by the hole 5 feet above the hole.
Oh, no. Okay.
So he's got the 5 foot downhill breaking sliding putt for his life.
Right, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And as we all know, he makes it. He made it. And to see the reaction on the kid, and just, he almost collapsed, you know.
Oh, my gosh. How good is that?
So he's in the top 30. I don't think he can win the FedEx Cup, but he gets a bunch of exemptions. And I said, Russ, was there ever a day, was there a turning point, something in your life that was, and maybe it's not even sports, I don't know, that was life-altering, like one moment that sticks out for you that... sort of change the course of your life?
Professionally, when I was first starting out and I was struggling, and I told you that rumor about me getting sent to the minors, I picked up my game, my practice, and I really started focusing more. I was scared to go down. I didn't want to go to the minors. Nobody does.
Right.
And so I played in Chicago, and I got 3 or 4 points, I think. I played against Chicago.
Right.
I got 3 or 4 points, and that's a big deal, you know, when you're coming. Yeah, but it was a big deal. But late November, I think November 19th or 23rd, something like that. I remember this date. It's either or 19th, because it was my dad's birthday, or a few days after his birthday on the 23rd. I played against Detroit, and I had my best game ever. I had 3 goals and 3 assists, and from that moment on, I was considered an NHLer. And so those two games were very close, so like a week apart.
Yep.
And now people start believing, you know, why they drafted me in Toronto, and it just gave me the confidence that I could play in the NHL, and that was, you know, a couple of years into my career, so it really gave me the confidence that I belonged and I could play at that level. So that was a big moment for me in my life, my career.
Right. It makes me think, Russ, that people, when you tell that story without hesitation, I thought maybe he has something, maybe he doesn't, but I'll ask, you know, and so you don't even pause and go, here it is, you know, it's these, mm-hmm. these two games. It makes me think, Russ, that one of the tough sides of hockey and sports is the unbelievable pressure and anxiety to perform. That if you don't, it bodes well. It bodes not well for you if you don't. And I wondered, you got a kid who's in hockey. What would you tell him is going to be the toughest thing? Or the downside, Russ, about playing pro sports?
I don't want to talk to him about the negatives. I want to talk to him about the positives. And the good thing about Lawton is he knows what type of player he is. And the hard thing for a lot of players is not having the identity yet in the NHL. They were drafted as an offensive player, and now they're on the bubble. They're not a top six.
Right.
They're not a fourth liner, and then they got a, you know, they've got to figure out their game to play as a third liner, and they've never been a third liner in their life. So fitting in and becoming an NHL player might not be the picture that you've dreamt of as a kid growing up or playing that way. I was an offensive guy who then, when I went to Montreal, I started playing with Guy Carboneau and Mike McPhee, on a defensive line, but we still put up points. And that kind of followed me through my career, that I was able to do both. And if I had have said no to that, then I might not have stayed in the NHL. I might have been in the minors, because a lot of players don't listen and they're not willing to change because they think there's something. They're not at that level. They were that when they were a kid, and now they're not. And so to stay, you have to reinvent yourself. And if you're not willing to reinvent, probably in all aspects of life, that you get left behind and you're going to lose out. Because if you can reinvent yourself and still do what you love to do, you can have a long career. And that's what happened to me in my fifth or sixth year. Pat Burns said, no, you're not playing center anymore. You're going to be right wing. Well, I just shut my mouth and I did it. I didn't like it, but I did it. And then he put me on the checking line. And Guy Carbonneau was such a freaking awesome passer and had an offensive brain from when he played in juniors. And every time he got the puck, he tried to pass it to me, and we tried to score. And so I'm like, oh, my God, I got the best of both worlds here. I'm playing against the other team's top line, who are normally not great off defensively. And I'm on the ice more often than not. I'm penalty killing. I wish I was on the power play more, but you know what? The only thing that pissed me off is I wasn't on the power play more. I always thought, you know, I should play on the power play. But anyways,
everyone does.
Yeah. But I did love what I ended up, you know, becoming, which was a two-way player. And if I hadn't have had an open mind, I would have been frickin' in Sherbrooke, you know, learning French.
Right. there's no doubt, Russ, that hockey can be the most rewarding thing in the world, all the events that have happened in your life and mm-hmm. all the great things. But would you agree, Russ, it can also be the most humbling?
Yeah, I mean, especially towards the end of your career, these young guys coming up, and I was one of those young guys, and they're hungry for your position, and there's no like, oh, put the poor old guy that's, you know, had played 15 and 16 years in the NHL, they're chomping at the bit to take everything away from you. So that part's tough. But every player goes through it, whatever those last 2 years are of their career, and most people don't even know when those 2 years are till it's over.
This may be a dumb question, and I've asked a bunch.
Oh, fuck. We know it.
I still get sympathy emails from people going, are you okay after today's show? I do. I said, fuck, I love it. Are you kidding me? I love it. Russ, if you had your choice, say with your own children or somebody else you were mentoring, like I say, this may be a dumb question. What sport out of the four majors, baseball, basketball, football, hockey, and let's throw soccer in there, or any other sport you can think of, race car driving, whatever, what sport would you pick or hope that your kid would want to do? Is it hockey for sure, or I don't know? That's why I ask.
Well, when I first retired, we were living in LA, and Allie played basketball, soccer, ran track, all the California sports. Lawton has baseball, flag football, soccer, and I didn't take him to hockey. And then we moved to Victoria, and he was seven, and he was like, I want to play hockey. And I wasn't putting it out there for him, so he started a little late for hockey. But when I was living in California, I was like, you know what, I want him to do these other things, and then hockey came last because
really,
okay. Yeah, because I had just made up my mind. I hung out with Gretz a lot. He was just like, you know, it's not fair. It's California. Dad's played in the NHL, especially him. He was more talking about him. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm living in California. He can play baseball. He can do all these other things. And then hockey happened. And it's not easy when the dad played in the NHL. It's not easy on the kid. And to be honest, it's not fair. A lot of people judge your kid because you played, and they're harsh. They can be harsh.
Judge them through the minors, yeah. You mean, like playing. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's a lot of dads out there who want to be coaches, and then as soon as an ex-NHL player walks in the room, they think they're not going to be able to coach, so then the insecurities come flying out of them, and I've, you know, we've all heard the stories of hockey dads that were ex-NHL players, and they weren't, you know, they didn't want them to coach. It's like, right. You know, having Warren Buffett run the school fund for the PTA, and no, you know, a bunch of people don't want him to invest the money because he knows what he's doing.
Right.
Like, it makes no makes no sense.
Right.
But anyways, I didn't want to be in a rink with and have to deal with that. And then after he decided to play, I was all in. I coached. I started out as an assistant coach. Mm-hmm. And then I became a head coach, and then I went back to being an assistant coach, and then a fan and a parent. You know, after he left home, I was just like anybody else, and I was all in. Once he said, I want to play, then I was all in, and I loved it. And I had some right. really fun moments. We had played on a couple good teams and a lot of Bad News Bears teams, but some funny moments from coaching and mentoring kids and trying to teach them, you know, team characteristics of what makes that team good, and then the work ethic part. And it was, oh my God, there were so many good stories about
right.
different kids that I coached. And Lawton usually brings them up, and then, Dad, tell the story about this guy and that guy.
Well, could you imagine as a kid how awesome it would be to have an NHL player as a coach?
Room? They don't know until the parents tell them, because they're so young, right?
Right, right.
So they don't know. If the parents didn't say anything, they wouldn't know you played in the NHL.
Right. Okay, a couple more things, Russ, and then we got to get out of here. But I've a big dirty hit in the Tampa-Boston series. I looked at it. It was Bruins, Nick Ricci, full-on boarding of Yanni Gourde, I guess is his name, with Tampa. Anyway, the guy goes in towards the boards, gets rid of the puck. He's got his back to the defender, and the puck is clearly gone. So that's a one against you. He's got his back to him, another against you. He lines him up as another one, and then runs him mm-hmm. and checks him into the boards, gets a five-minute major. But in my mind, I've seen dirty hits. But it was super dirty. And I guess the question is, this isn't new in the NHL. But come playoffs, Russ, is it sort of like, is the coach sort of maybe turn a blind eye a little bit and go, you might have to take one for the team and step it up a notch, be dirtier?
No, you always want to be tough, and you want to play harder. Mm-hmm. Your hardest in the playoffs right. because it's so important, not that you don't during the regular season, but the playoffs, the intensity level definitely picks up. And that play, nobody wants that play, because one, your player can get hurt. Two, the other team's going to get penalized and possibly lose a player. So both coaches are going to be upset, whether the coach on the, on Boston says that, he in the locker room, he's going, fuck, why did you do that? You know it's a penalty. You know, you gotta control your emotions. And they want you to play at the highest level, but control your emotions.
Yeah,
and
it's impossible.
And that's why when I played, a lot of guys, the fighters, never played in the playoffs, because they couldn't control their emotions, because that's not what they're meant. They weren't meant to be out there, you know, talking to people. They're out there to hammer and freaking possibly beat the shit out of somebody. And you, right. there was no fighting in the playoffs.
Right.
You know, very few fights in the playoffs. And so you just didn't want to get, you didn't want to have a penalty and have them have a power play with an unnecessary penalty. And it's tough to have players all jacked up to play and then tell them, oh yeah, but don't do this, don't right. do that. I mean, it's a fine line, but no coach wants to see a player get hit from behind either way. It's just, it's too dangerous. And I think we've done a good job of eliminating the head shots and the hits from behind are getting better and better, because, you know, players don't want to lose money. They don't want to get suspended and miss games, and they don't want to penalize their team, but it's taken a while But right. we're getting there. It's getting better. It's not out of the game yet. And I wonder if players are more relaxed now going into the, you know, head first into the, or going in facing the boards now because they know they're not going to get hit. And then the odd time you get something like that where the guy just hammers you, because we were always ready for a hit. You know, you knew when you were going to get hit and you would prepare yourself and you'd either go with it. And the only time that you really got hurt is if you had your head down, you didn't see the guy coming. But if you, it doesn't matter how big or small you are, if you see the guy coming, you can prepare for it.
So what I take away from that, Russ, is what you're saying is it's way easy, it's way tougher than you think not to stay unemotional in a hockey game.
And now that the guys are fired up on caffeine, they've drank like 42 cups of coffee and they're ready to play and play at the highest level, and they're out there flying around a million miles an hour and things happen really quickly. Right. So it's that player doesn't want to take a penalty. Nobody does.
Good stuff, Rusty. Before we go, this was a terrible week for an incident that happened. Jacob Blake was a black man who had stopped his van. I don't want to leave out too many details of it. To break up a fight or something, the police showed up in the scene. He went to go back into his van. If you've seen the video, and there was a policeman right behind him with virtually the barrel of the gun was on his back, and he shot him 7 times. The latest I hear is that the guy's paralyzed.
Yes.
So massive, massive fallout from this thing, again, about police brutality. And as a result, in the world of sports, which we look at, a bunch of games were postponed. It generated a bunch of meetings by players to talk about it, what they wanted to do. It perpetuated, protests again, and eventually evolved into players postponing games. There's the obvious of what people have to do about this thing. You know, it's crazy. People are little quick to jump always, I think, a little bit until we... Because there's more drifting in now. If you look at the video, it looks very one-sided, you know, and you don't know what's going on. But now there's stories coming out where this guy had a knife in his hand or was reaching for something in the van. So we've got to wait for all that to come out. But I've got to admit, Russ, and hear me out on this first before you yell at me. I wasn't big on players postponing games for a couple reasons. One, I think it perpetuates a lot of negative connotations in this thing, and young people look at this. And I think it can breed more contempt with people saying, okay, right on, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this, we're not going to do this. So I always wondered, and I borrow that from you when we go back to the Kaepernick thing, where at the time there was big outrage about what he did, but now that looks very peaceful compared to what's going on now. I don't like it. The other reason, Russ, is I think you're holding a league and you're holding team members or team owners hostage to something they had nothing to do with, by stopping down and not going to play these games. And the poor owners are going, well, wait a minute here. Well, let's do something about it, but let's not stop playing here. You know, I think it's unfair, you know, that they go ahead and do this. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, Russ, but I kind of come up with that side of it. I don't like it. I don't like what they did, and I think there's other ways they could have done it. Well, I'll read you one thing. The president of the Las Vegas Police Union, a guy named Steve Grammas. So he comes out, because the Golden Knights, I think, postponed one of their games too and had meetings about it, what they wanted to do. And he writes this ripping letter to the team. It appears the Golden Knights would rather jump on the bandwagon of attacking the profession rather than waiting for the facts of the events to be brought to light. And I think you said that right to Pete DeBoer or the owner of the team or something. DeBoer, of course, had a great reaction to it, saying, wait a minute here, you know, we're fully behind the cops and stuff like that. So what did you think about all of that, Russ? What's your...
I had a conversation yesterday with one of our players' wives. She asked me what I thought, and I said... I said, everybody knows I'm dead. I just do not like the kneeling during the anthem. I'm too proud, a Canadian, live in the United States, proud of my family, being American citizens. Right. And people die for our right to, protest and, I guess, kneel. But they still die for the freedoms that we have in this country. But the racism in our country and countries is got to stop. And I think what the two-day delay does is it gets a conversation going. And I read some comments of people who have no clue. They've never had to deal with racism in their life. And they're quick to react on their comments. And I think what we need to do is we need to listen and we need to learn more. And then we have to treat one another with respect. This incident, I think Will Smith said it best. He said, now it's just being filmed. And we do need to wait for the facts. But the initial reaction of social media is just, boom, the person's guilty, and boom, look what happened, look what they said, and then we all react too quickly, and we love our police officers. And I love that I read that article that the police chief from Las Vegas wrote, and he said, no one dislikes a bad cop more than a good cop.
Right.
I thought that was a great line, and it's true. I had two uncles that were RCMP officers, and if I didn't play in the NHL, I probably was going to be a police officer. Mm-hmm. And so might have my brother Jeff. But I think that we're talking about stuff, and it's unfortunate this incident happened. I don't know a lot about, now we're hearing more and more bad stuff about this person. So let's wait. I think I talked to my brother Jeff, and he said, the guy who shot him looked like he just panicked. And I don't understand. If you're wearing a freaking bulletproof vest and you have a gun and a guy's running away from you to potentially get a weapon, that's what they're saying, right? Maybe he mm-hmm. was going to go to the car and get a weapon. Well, let him mm-hmm. turn around and fucking blow his head off. Like, if the guy does that, then you have every right to protect yourself. But shooting somebody in the frickin' back mm-hmm. while they're going to their car, are you kidding me? Mm-hmm. Like, shoot them in the frickin' knee. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. seven frickin' times in the back? I mean, right. How does that make any sense? So obviously the guy who did it has no balls, probably, and wasn't trained properly. So that's where I stand on it. It shouldn't have happened, and it's unfortunate it happened, and now we're going to, find out all the evidence that both right. sides are going to put out. But it's terrible. But I think the good thing, forget that part, the two-day delay is, people are talking. It's a conversation that people are having
right.
about what's going on in this country and in Canada. And I think that the conversation, Lawton and I had a conversation with a fellow member. He texted us the next day. We were talking about racism, and he felt really bad because we were drinking and we were just talking. Mm-hmm. And he felt so bad that we were talking about racism. He texted us the next day and felt like he was out of line. And Lawton goes, Dad, I would rather talk about it than walk on fucking eggshells than just walking on eggshells around people. He goes, right. I love the conversation. And he goes, Dad, it was a conversation. And right. he wrote back this beautiful text to this guy going, you're the nicest family I've ever met. And I didn't take any offense. We were just talking about racism.
Right.
But people are so uncomfortable who are to talk about it. They feel guilty if they do. And I just think that the best part of all this is we're talking about it.
Yeah. And you make a great point. That's one, you got to ask yourself why when you bring that up. It's like, why are people so nervous about talking about it? Well, that shows you how far back we are still, about it, right? About having the conversation. And the other thing, Russ, too, is I think people have to remember, terrible things are going to happen. Terrible things are going to happen regardless of what's going on. And you may be dealing with a guy who snapped.
Yeah.
You may be dealing with a guy who's off balance. You may be dealing with a guy who's got some mental issues, you know, and that happens.
I'll give you an example of a St. Louis cop got shot the other day, and we're not, you don't hear that on the media. I don't know if he's black, white, whatever, but a guy shot up, killed a police officer, and I saw it on Instagram, and and I don't see that blasted all over the news that some guy goes to some house and then freaking gets killed. So
yeah, and is it a racist issue, right? Well, that one, I think people have to wait. They got to wait and see what happens out of this thing, right? They got to wait and see what happens.
Well, shooting anybody in the back, that's a joke.
Right.
I mean,
but really, is it racist? My point is.
I know that. I get that part, but fucking shooting a guy in the back 7 times?
Something wrong with you.
Come on. Really? Right. You got a gun in your hand and a bulletproof vest and like 7 or 8 other cops around you? I mean, jeez.
Right. Right.
Like, that guy would take that day back.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Anyway, good stuff for us. We needed to talk about it. People were asking me this week if we were going to bring it up, and I said, yep, absolutely. I'll ask Russ about it, and you've been affected by it more than I ever will be, with your family being mixed and your wife being black, and terrible. Terrible this shit happens. But I thought, I was hoping they wouldn't, because I think it perpetuates a bunch of other protesting and shit, and protesting doesn't seem to go well when it comes to this, if we look back at when George Floyd got killed by a police officer. But, you know, in fairness to sports, they're pressured into reacting, and let's all congratulate them on what they did, whether you agree with it or not, about doing something. So, Rusty, that is the end of the show. What are you up to now? You said you got to go. We have to wind up early here. I'd like to go longer, but we went an hour. What are you doing today? What do you mean you're on a tour? What sort of tour?
I've got a gentleman from LA coming in. He wants to tour Gosser, so I gotta meet him in like 10 minutes, show him around. He's never been here, and hopefully sell him some.
I got a note, Russ, from the last guy you took on one of those tours.
Yeah.
I do. Okay. He's a mutual friend of ours.
And, yeah, right.
So he went down to Gosser to see all the highlights, all the features, and I said, how'd the tour go? He said, I'll tell you what, I know that bar well. We spent 3.5 hours there. I didn't see anything else.
Hey, the tree bar. I've sold 2 or 3 places hanging out at the tree bar.
I know you have, brother.
I got pictures.
I know.
I got pictures to prove it.
Yeah, you should be there. You should be there paying for that thing.
It's closed.
Well, pay them to reopen it,
yeah,
pal.
No shit.
Closing deals.
No shit.
The best deals are done in the bar. Okay, everybody, enjoy the rest of your week. Rusty, thanks a lot. You've been listening to another episode of The Suspendables with me, Jungle Jim Jerome, and him, Russ Courtnell. Take care, everybody. See you, Rusty.
Adios.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Courtnell in LA. Follow The Suspendables on Facebook and Twitter. Reach us at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. And of course, we appreciate you sharing this podcast with your group of friends.